another day, another dollar makes you wonder where your money went. You can scream.
Hi folks, this is Jack Spirico with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things that we can all do to live a better life if times get tough. Or even if they don't, dictated from the home office, which will be the norm. We'll do an occasional road show, but we are big into the new year, and I'm big into doing this thing full time. Last week I went away, left Wednesday afternoon about 2 o'clock to beat the ice storm that we were expecting in Arkansas. We didn't really get an ice storm up there, but it was good to leave a bit early. But I did have shows set up for you for Thursday and Friday. I hope everybody enjoyed those shows. I got some good feedback on them, so I guess you did. It's my commitment to do everything I can to make TSP a 5-day-a-week show always, especially now. And to actually start doing some special shows, maybe 2 to 3 shows a week in addition to what I'm already doing, with some more stuff on libertarian politics and current events to kind of separate those two. So there might be a political Monday half hour, a political Wednesday half hour, and a political Friday half hour in the very near future, as soon as I get a few more things set up. And then it'll still be the 5 shows a week. I got to do something with my time now that I've liberated myself, right? Okay, so, and I know people like that stuff, and I know some people don't. So my thought is maybe we can give you the best of both worlds, because whether you believe it or not, those things are important. Those things affect us. And we'll occasionally talk about some politics here, but most we're going to talk about practical prepping and answering questions. And when we do question shows like today, we will talk about politics as much as you guys ask me to. Let's put it that way. All right, before we do today's show, though, let's say today is episode 353 of the Survival Podcast. It's Monday, January 11th, 2010. And we are going to do our traditional Monday show of listener questions. Before that, we're going to introduce our sponsors of the day today. Sponsor of the day number one today is Sawtooth Tactical. They have some really cool things, man. I want you to check their site out, see if there's something cool there that's lacking from your preps. Maybe give these guys a bit of business. And if you tell them that you found them through the Survival Podcast, when you check out, they'll send you a free 50-foot hank of paracord rope. So you get a little extra bonus from them for doing that. The other sponsor today is the Berkey guy with Directive21.com. Again, Directive21.com is the Berkey guy's website. All models and all accessories for Berkey water filters. Water is the essence of life. Without that, you don't have anything. Berkey water filters will help you make sure that you always have a good, clean supply of water available, and the Berkey guy will help you pick out exactly what you want. Check out his site, and if you're looking to increase your preps, increase the availability of fresh water. That's one of the biggest things you can do. All right, with that knocked out, let's go ahead and take care of the rest of the housekeeping real quick like today. Number one, join the forum. Become part of our community. Number two, check out my YouTube channel and subscribe to it. I got some really cool contests coming in the next 20 days. A bunch of contests, a bunch of free stuff, a bunch of cool stuff. At least half of them are going to require you to be a YouTube subscriber to play in the contest. Check out the Survival Podcast Gear Shop. Really cool stuff. The t-shirts are just awesome. I've got Sis Wolf sending me a bunch more of them, and we're going to give away a few t-shirts in the future, too. All right, last but not least, consider joining the Member Support Brigade. You'll get exclusive content available only to members. I wanted to let you know about another new benefit for the MSB today. Not available yet, but will be this week. We'll get the final technology things worked out so that we can go ahead and start making this available to you. But I contacted Seeds of Change, which is one of my favorite places to order organic seeds from. And they did get back to me. I contacted them kind of in the break between Christmas and New Year's, and they just got back to me while I was away. So I just sent them back an email and said, definitely we can work something out with the terms they have. But basically, we're going to be giving some kind of a discount to all orders from Seeds of Change to MSB members. So we keep growing that. And I mean, like I said, 2010 is going to be a big year for that. We've added in 2010 now, this will make our third new vendor. And I've got two other ones that are getting some things taken care of that I'll tell you about when they become available. Backwoods Home was just added. You get a free book with a subscription. They just sent me a bunch of books, and there's one I'm going to review for you that's not available in the offer, but I think I'm really going to like it. I haven't read it yet, but when I got back, there was a big pile of stuff waiting for me, and that was one of them. So I'll let you know how that goes from here out. All right, with that, we're done with the housekeeping. Let's get into today's show. I want to start out with maybe not some questions, but some stuff that's been sent to me and some suggestions and things like that that people have found. I want to start out with something that's going to tell you why you have to research everything that you would ever find in an email that would come to you. I got an email from a person named Chris, and Chris sends this email out, and here's what it says. Wasp spray. When asked by a concerned person about using pepper spray, the local police department recommended that she get a can of wasp spray instead. The wasp spray, they told her, can shoot up to 25 feet away and is more accurate. While the pepper spray, they have to get too close and could overpower you. The wasp spray temporarily binds the attacker until they get to the hospital for an antidote. Wasp and hornet spray. On the heels of a break-in and beating in Toledo, a self-defense expert had a tip that could save your life. A teacher in the art of self-defense told his students for decades, keep a can of wasp spray or hornet spray near the door and the bed. This is better than anything I could teach them. It's inexpensive, easy to find, and more effective than mace or pepper spray. The cans typically shoot 20 to 30 feet, so if somebody tries to break in your home, spray the culprit in the eyes. It's going to give you a chance to call police, maybe get out, maybe save your life. Please share this. It could save a life. Well, nothing wrong with that, right? Except that it's not exactly true. If you spray somebody in the face with wasp and hornet spray, it probably is going to blind them, at least temporarily, if not permanently. There's a website every single person that gets emails like this needs to be aware of. It's called Snopes, SNOPES.com. Please look stuff like this up before you start repeating it or going around and suggesting that people do it. Here's the issues with this. Number one, no police department has ever, and that's how this email starts out, no police department has ever made this recommendation. There is a martial arts instructor, okay, who does recommend this, apparently, but he's not working with a college and woman's self-defense. He's at a high school. And he's not a lawyer. And here's the issues. On the can of wasp spray, it says that it's in violation of federal law to use this product in a manner inappropriate with its intended use or per its directions or something like that. So if you specifically, so that would mean when the police come, I kept this can of wasp spray in case something like this happened, say something like that, you've clearly intended to use the product in a violation of federal law, who knows what they might do to you. And if you think that we can't do stupid things with our judicial system, you're not paying attention. So there's another problem. Now, where do I see value in this? I don't see it in that it's got a longer range. I'm sure there's a lot of pepper spray out there that has a short range. The stuff I carry on my key ring has a short range, right? Here's the thing. If you want pepper spray that can spray that far, then they make big giant cans of it that will spray that far, just like a big giant can of wasp spray. It's about the amount of propellant and the ratio and the containment system that controls. That's why the smaller stuff you can carry, like on a key ring, doesn't necessarily have the range, right? I bet you that the people that are immune to pepper spray are not immune to wasp spray. There's a reason police departments don't carry wasp spray around. It is a neurotoxin. So where do I see the value in this? Hey, if somebody breaks into your home, I'm not really worried about hurting them. They should have broken into my home. And if I happen to have a can of wasp spray around, and that's the only thing I can get to because I'm not carrying a gun or I live somewhere where it's not available, A, as a last-ditch effort, you know, I'd rather argue with the police than argue with the guy that wants to hurt me or my family. Additionally, it's something I never thought of as a shit-hit-the-fan thing. It's a lot less expensive than pepper spray. It is useful for the elimination of wasps and hornets' nests when they get into bad places. I don't like insecticides. This is probably the one that I'm willing to use because of how bad an infestation of hornets or wasps can be in the wrong place and how much trouble it can cause and how much pain it can cause. So I'd like to have it around anyway, but it should hit the fan. I'm not really worried about whether it's a violation of federal law to spray somebody that's trying to hurt me or my family with wasp spray. So I'm not saying that it won't work. I'm saying that to pass it around, this way in this form with an email is irresponsible because it could get somebody put in jail or sued. And that's the big one I worry about. If you spray some criminal that comes to your house with this stuff, odds are you're going to get sued by him and his family. So I would stick to wherever it's legal, a gun, because that's how you defend your home well. And if you shoot somebody because you had to, and God forbid you ever had, I'm not advocating we should all be waiting for someone to break in our house or something. You guys get this. I want the people that maybe are tuning in for the first time to understand it's not like some kind of extremist thing here or something. But that if you do have to shoot somebody, you're following the law of the land in most places in the United States. And you'll probably only be one side of the story. And in a legal situation, that is helpful. Would I use it? In a New York second. If somebody broke in this house right now and I just happened to have a can of wasp spray out because I had terminated him outside and he was coming towards me and that can was there, I'd spray his face and I would give him a bath in it. And I bet you it would work. So, is it effective? Probably. Can it get you into legal trouble? Probably. May at some point it not matter? Definitely. But should emails like this be taken at face value? Absolutely, positively not. I want to read a real quick one to you here from somebody who sent me because a quick email. Hi, Jack. Experienced the 6.5 earthquake in Humboldt County yesterday. What a wake-up call. I've been listening to you for a year, and when the shit hit the fan, I was out of D batteries and only had enough drinking water for 2 days. Encourage your listeners to test their preparedness and be ready at all times. And this came from Jay. Jay, I could not agree more, and I chose to read your email right about the same time I'm about to tell you guys what happened to me this time in Arkansas. And it seems like every time I go up to this place, we get our preps checked. A year ago, roughly, we had the well get struck by lightning and had no water for 3 days because it happened right in the middle of the holidays, the Christmas holiday time between New Year's and Christmas, and everybody was off. And even though it was a $78 part, easy to replace, we couldn't get one for 3 days. Then this summer we had the truck break down about 3 miles from any place in either direction, and we ended up stranded at the bug out location with no transportation for a couple days, which was fine. Well, this time what we ended up with is we ended up there during, as everybody probably knows, the coldest snap of weather that we've experienced in the United States for like 10 or 15 years, and it was 7 degrees out Saturday night. And guess what happened about 10 o'clock? Power goes out. No electricity. Meaning, two things for us at the bug out location. We have no heat from our electric furnace, and we have no water because our pump runs on an electric pump. Now, we've thought about getting a hand pump. It's probably a good idea in the future, and we'll probably do it. But even if we had that, we're not going to be out in 7-degree weather at night during a power failure running it. Now, we had some other things there that we could have used to get through this. But what we decided to do was, okay, let's use this, and let's learn from it. So what we did is we went in and immediately we already had the fire going. Stoked the fire up, went out on the porch, we had a whole bunch of wood, brought all the wood that was on the porch in so we didn't have to open the door again. Closed the doors, closed the rooms, the doors to all the rooms except for the living room. So we're heating the smallest area possible. We pulled the couch up in front of the fireplace far enough back that there was room to lay on the floor. Put down a bed pad. My wife slept on the floor. I slept on the couch. This allowed the couch to reflect the heat back to my wife, and the higher part of the couch reflected heat back to me, and staggered our bodies so that we were both absorbing heat without one blocking the other one's out, and letting the full length of the body lay against the heat. I had a little compass thermometer in my bug out bag. Pulled that out. The temperature in that area stayed in the high 50s throughout the blackout. The temperature in the other areas of the house got down near, and even in some areas of the house, I went and checked later in the evening with a flashlight and a thermometer, left it there, down to near freezing. The outside temperature was 7 degrees. So we were able to keep the area in the living room in the high 50s, while other parts of the house were below freezing. The exterior temperature was 7 degrees with just the fireplace. Power came on about 2:30 in the morning, came back on. So that wasn't too bad. We went to bed, And I woke up about 6:30 a.m., I would say, and the house was freezing cold again. So I started mumbling something about, you know, my wife turning the temperature down. What the heck's wrong with her? We waited for it to come back on. And wandered, and it was enough light coming in I could see. I wandered back into the area where the thermostat was, and it was sitting right where it was when I left, and I started playing with it and realized the power's out again. So I decided to go ahead and get up, covered my wife with the extra covers, broke out my little camping stove, and made coffee. How'd I make coffee? Electric coffee maker, you know, didn't have a percolator. Take the electric coffee maker, set it up like you're going to normally make coffee, put your water in your pot, boil it, open the top of the coffee maker and start pouring it through the strainer. Same thing. Coffee's made. When the pot cooled down a little bit, threw it back on the stove and heated it back up. So we had coffee, made some oatmeal, made a little toast with the stove, and had breakfast. And then about 9:30, 10 o'clock in the morning, the power came back on. We packed up and, you know, headed back here yesterday and got home about 5 o'clock. So there was our little preparedness drill. Now, what did we do when we had the fire raging? We weren't really ready to go to sleep, and we're just sitting there. Well, we got our little Grundig radio out, cranked it up, turned it on, and found a local station, some guy that was reading supposedly messages from the other side from dead people, which was entertaining, so we listened to him, and we sat there with a list, and we looked at everything that we had and everything that we didn't have in this experience and said, okay, we're leaving tomorrow, this is no big deal, what if we were stuck here for a month this way, what are we lacking? We came away with a list of things to further improve our preps at the bug out location. Same scenario. This guy ends up in an earthquake and he realizes, hey, here's the things that I didn't do that I knew I should do. So I really want to encourage you guys. I want you to understand this type of thing happens every day. It happens all the time. It's not just what if the world ends. It's what if there's a problem where you are. Last year when we had the big ice storm, there were people that went 3 weeks in the situation that I just described with temperatures sub-freezing during those entire 3 weeks. So it's really important that we make sure that we're ready, and as this gentleman suggests, Jay suggests, that we occasionally test our preps rather than just waiting for nature to do something to test it for us. Or when nature tests us and it's not that big a deal, resist the temptation. This is the big one. Resist the temptation to use everything that you have immediately to deal with the situation. Don't necessarily fire up the generator for one night without power. See if you can deal with it. Now, if there's people in the house that need in the heat, air conditioning, or in the wintertime, they need heat and it's beyond what you can do, then you go ahead and you do it. Don't suffer through it. But, you know, if it's just going to be a few hours without power, see what you can do with the minimalist things. Because that's what's going to help you realize that generator has a finite lifespan. So if you ended up in a situation where everybody's running on generator power and nobody has any electricity, it may be hard to get gasoline 2.5-3 weeks into it. Really hard. So that generator may not be running anymore. You might find it financially not be able to run it much longer than that. It itself could break down at some point. You might not be able to repair it for a certain number of days or to get another part or get another generator. So resist the temptation to go fire that generator. But let me tell you, part of that was I don't want to go outside, fire up a generator, plug it in when it's 7 degrees outside if I don't have to. One night we can get through that. And then I have the morning, and it's light outside. If it's going to be a long-term blackout, we get that thing running, and we're not worried about the stuff obviously melting in the refrigerator or freezer or anything like that during just that overnight period. So try these things when these things happen. Just use them as opportunities to learn, and better yet, give yourself a 2-hour blackout. You can do it anytime you want. You go out to your circuit breaker. It's a great big breaker that says main. Throw it for 2 hours. And see how you'll deal with it. And during the time you're dealing with it, forget that you have the power to turn it back on. Just put some candles on. Put some lights on. Sit down like they did in the old days. Maybe listen to the radio. Think, if we were going to be here for 3 weeks, what would this be like? What are we lacking? And make a list and take action on it. All right, let's go ahead and take a question. Here's a very interesting question / comment. I don't know how much this has to do with direct survivalism, but it's a fair enough question. It's been asked, and I think maybe people can learn something about humanity from this, and maybe the word tolerance and understanding a little bit about tolerance. If you want tolerance, you must be tolerant. Because I find a little bit of this to be kind of snippy, not real bad, but just kind of snippy and kind of maybe a little bit of holier than thou. And here from a friend we'll call Charlie. Charlie, and to be fair, Charlie's a nice guy. He says, thanks for everything you do. I've been meaning to write for some time, let you know how much I appreciate your show, your views, and your teachings. I have a few questions for you and some feedback. First, are you Catholic or used to be Catholic? Strangely enough, the answer is yes. Now, I would say that I really used to be Catholic, like a really used to be a really long time ago. I would not call myself a Catholic, I would say, since about the age of 12 or 13. About that point, my family split up and I was stopped forcing to go to church, and my heart was never in going to the Catholic Church in the first place. But if you grow up in a Catholic family, you're going to go. I was kind of a unique Catholic in a way as well. My family, as I've mentioned in the past, was at least a large part of them from Ukraine. And there's a little denomination of Catholics that are separate from the Roman Catholic Church, or Ukrainian Catholic, which means a lot of times when my grandmother would drag me off to church, I would listen to a priest speak Ukrainian during a high mass and have no idea what he was talking about. And I was told it didn't matter, I just needed to be there for the experience. So I was Catholic, and I quit. And interestingly enough, I've had people that are Catholics tell me, you can't quit, you can quit anything. Being Catholic is not like being born Caucasian or Hispanic or male or female or anything else like that. It's a choice, and my choice was, as soon as I was old enough to enact my free will, to stop being part of it, because it wasn't for me. All right. Second, you mentioned a while back about overpopulation, how you had only one child because of this. I wanted to challenge your notions concerning this. Fine. Overpopulation is a myth, and in fact, America will soon be declining in population just like Europe. My response, good. We don't need more people here. We have enough. We have enough. We would already be if it weren't for the influx of Mexicans. My friend, I don't like illegal immigration either, but you are so off your rocker with this attack against Mexicans. Mexicans are one part of both the legal and illegal immigration issues that we have. There are plenty of people coming here from all other parts of the world. You just probably, like me, live in a place where you see mostly Mexicans. They're a little bit more high profile. They're a little bit more easy to identify. But there are plenty of illegal immigrants here from plenty of places other than Mexicans that continue to fuel growth of the population. You are an influential man. I hope you can clear some things up with you, put forth its truth, which is completely false, and only the doctrine of the insane environmentalists, who, in my opinion, should go kill themselves because are using too much carbon according to their own doctrine. See what I need about tolerance on our friend Charlie? Also, it is a normal mindset of a libertarian to let everyone do what they want as long as it doesn't hurt others. I'm a little unclear on where you stand on concerning this issue called moral relativism. I'm sure you know that. Well, here's where I stand, Charlie. It's my freaking business what I choose to do with my life and how many kids I choose to have. It's your business with how many kids you choose to have. But when you get preachy with me because of my choice, you're not being a good libertarian. And I can't stand libertarians that do this shit. This is nonsense. This is crap. We want freedom of choice for everybody as long as your choice is like mine. Or as long as you pay homage to my choice. I don't care if I'm an influential man. I don't have to pay homage to your choice every time I talk about mine. I don't have to always say, I chose this, but it's okay if you chose that. Grow up. Grow up and quit expecting everybody to coddle you and make you feel good about your choice. If you want to have 80 kids, I don't care. Go ahead. I actually believe that long-term, humanity itself will choose to reduce the population of the planet to something more manageable and sustainable, and that people will move out of the cities into the country. The only way for that to happen is for there to be less of a population burden, so there's enough room for people. There's not enough room for everybody. There's not enough food for everybody. There's not enough water for everybody. Now, I'm not going to make that choice. I damn sure don't want the government making that choice, and I damn sure don't want anybody forcing that choice on anybody else. I don't want a system like China has. And to infer that I do shows that you haven't been paying attention, despite you saying thanks for everything you do, and me being a Catholic has nothing to do with that, okay? It has to do with a reality. There's only so much resources. And every species that's crashed does so after a period of overpopulation. Now, you can bitch about environmentalists if you want, but if you don't acknowledge where they're right, again, that's your choice. It doesn't mean that people won't choose to do it. Let me tell you how it will really happen. More and more automation and quality of life things will be extended throughout the planet. The more that that happens, the less people, less children people naturally have. No one forced the decline in birth rates in the United States. Nobody. Nobody forced it. Now you can say, well, it was the feminists and Now you're just being a pain in the ass, okay? The reality is quality of life has gone up in the United States. And as people have gotten the ability to have more things and have more freedom, and when I talk about freedom, I'm talking about time freedom, and be able to travel and things like that, people have chosen, you know what, two kids, especially with both parents, well, that's enough. We'll have a couple kids, right? And that's great, and we'll pass on our family name, we'll pass on our lineage, but the days of most Americans, and if you do this, I don't care if you do this, it's okay, but if you, well, the days of most Americans, you know, cranking out six, seven, eight kids are over. And very few people actually want to do that anymore. And I think the problem with some people, like our friend Charlie here, is you want people doing it. Well, here's the thing. Free choice works both ways. I would quote a my overall tone from this email, my overall feeling from your email, Charlie, is there's a great, hilarious, stupid movie called Dodgeball. And kind of the villain guy in it, Dwight, at one point says, cram it up your cram hole. That's kind of my overall response to this email. Thanks, and then he ends with, Jack, thanks. You really helped my family and I in the pursuit of self-sustained lifestyle and family. I look forward to continue sorting your podcast forum, the MSB soon. Hey, you don't want to join the MSB because of what I said? Don't do it. And the podcast, Charlie. Again, hey, you make your own choice, but I made mine. And I do think that the population of the Earth is going to decline. It's going to happen one of two ways, through catastrophe or collective choice of the individual. When I say collective choice, I'm not talking about communist bullshit. I'm talking about if the majority of people choose to have less children, the population goes down. That's how it works. And even though our population is at a very level ascent in the United States, especially if we take out the immigration factor and their propensity coming from a place with less quality of life to continue to have these large families, even if you take the United States out of the equation, you take Europe out of the equation, the global population is still running away. And there's going to be a point, a peak. The peak stuff, the peak oil, the peak food, the peak water, folks, it's real. Now, my solution is not to tell anybody what to do with their life, but it's for everybody to start doing some things for themselves. And if we do that, I believe, again, that the problem will correct itself before it becomes a catastrophe. If we don't, sooner or later, catastrophe will fix the problem. Now, the government may have a evil or a benevolent hand of incompetence, either side of this. Doesn't matter. When there's not enough food for everybody, we have a problem. When there's not enough water for everybody, we have a problem. We have an entire population that doesn't know how to take care of itself, and energy fails, we have a problem. Believe whatever you want, do whatever you want, but realize that when you get that freedom, you give that freedom to other people, and if you don't like what I say, hit the fast forward button when I talk about something else. I think we've been on this one long enough. Just kind of irked me a little bit, so let's go ahead and take another question. Something totally different. Let's get off this. Okay, here we go. Totally different question. Nothing to do with the last one. Good segue out of it. Says, hi Jack, I have one side of my kitchen sink running out to my yard and the other still attached to the sewer. I also have my washer drain line running outside to the yard. My question is, I have a single story home and I was wondering how I can get the water from my shower drain piped outside so I can use that water in my yard too. Odds are, and this is from Jennifer, odds are, Jennifer, that you have a slab home like most Americans, and it might be really difficult to access your drain pipe that leads out to your sewer. And especially being specific with it to the point that it only affects the water that comes out of your shower drain. Especially with a single-story house, because that pipe's going to be coming right up the wall. I almost think that it's that barring, you know, major work that involves cutting away a piece of your foundation, which would be a very expensive proposition, it's probably not doable at this point. You might want to discuss it with a plumber or an irrigation specialist and say, can you give me a ballpark price on this? Because it's not something you're going to do yourself. It's going to involve entirely too much affecting of the structure of the house itself. So, is there another thing that we can do here? Yes, there is. There is one other thing that we can do here. We can catch some of the water from the shower and pour it down one of the drains in the house that leads to your gray water irrigation system. This is how I would advise you to do this. Get yourself a good old-fashioned 5-gallon bucket. Set that 5-gallon bucket in your shower. When you turn your shower on for the water to warm up, you waste a tremendous amount of water while you wait for the water that's in the hot water heater to get there. If there's enough room in your shower when you're taking your shower, when you step into the shower, push the bucket to one side or the other or somewhere where it's not really in your way but still catches some of the shower overspray. Take your shower, dry off, do your daily routine. That bucket will probably be damn near full. Go grab the bucket, carry the bucket to your sink, dump it into the side of your sink that goes to your gray water system, put the bucket back in the shower for the next time you take a shower. Manual, yes. Inconvenient, especially in a one-story home where you're not going up and down stairs. Not really. Not a big deal. Easy thing to do. Let's say that you take a shower every day and you catch 2.5 gallons, call it 3 gallons of water on average a day, and take a little bit out, so say 20 gallons a week. That's 80 gallons of water a month that can go to your gray water irrigation system, and relatively clean water. As well. I mean, as gray water goes, it's pretty clean because a large portion of it is going to be during the time where the water's heating up. You may find that even just that fills the bucket 2 gallons. It may be 2 gallons of water before the water gets warm. It might be more. And then the beauty of that is you can focus that so all of that water goes into the bucket and get yourself one of the shower heads that can be adjusted down to kind of a finer stream. And while it's warming up, adjust it down the stream, you get 100% of the water in that bucket. That's not even gray water. That's clean water. So you do whatever you like with it. So those are some of my thoughts on low-tech, low-cost ways to address that need, because I don't think tearing your foundation up to do it is going to really be worth doing unless you just decide to take all of the water. And I can't see this working for you. If you have a pier and beam house, odds are you can make this work. But if it's a slab foundation, and if somebody knows different, let me know. Now, let's talk about something that Jennifer did that I think is very smart. And maybe people missed it or don't understand why it was done. She said in her sink, she's a two-sided sink, one side goes outside, one side of the sink goes to the standard sewer. Why would you do that? Because if at any time you're putting something down the sink that you don't want to go out into your irrigation system for one reason or another, you have an option just by using the other side of the sink. I don't know how important that really is, because if it shouldn't go in your garden, I don't know that it should go down a sink. Obviously, we're not going to be putting our toilet water down our sink or anything like that, just to make, you know, blunt with it. So I don't know what might go down there except grease. And you really shouldn't be putting your grease into the sewer system anyway. But, you know, it probably is good to have the option to send stuff one place or the other, and what you've done is a very simple, easy way to do it. Try the bucket technique for the shower. I think you'll be surprised at how routine it would become after about 2 weeks. And again, 80 gallons of water, especially in some parts of the country, it's a lot of extra water every week to be using for irrigation purposes. If you tie your gray water into a drip irrigation system, you can really stretch its useful effectiveness. Let's find another question. That was a great one. Okay, here's kind of a unique one. I'm not quite exactly sure how to answer this one. It comes from a guy named John. John says, "Hi, Jack. This makes the second time I've written, but the first question I've ever sent. I understand if the shit hits the fan, junk coin silver could be valuable assets, given the right circumstances. What creative ways have you heard to acquire pre-64 coins, other than buying lots of them on eBay or through a coin or gold or silver dealer? I know these less than obvious methods may mean less yield short term, but I'd love to learn some different strategies. Thanks. Love your show, and quickly becoming a prepper, John." Okay. Here's the deal. The easiest, quickest, and probably the best way that I can think of to buy coins, especially in small amounts over time, is to find a good coin dealer or a good dealer on eBay and do exactly that. If you go by coins, now if you buy bullion, I think there's a sales tax exemption. I almost always buy my bullion by mail order, so I'm not sure. I can't remember the last time I went and bought gold or silver or gold eagles at a shop. But if I really don't think that Silver Eagles have a sales tax. I think they're exempt from it. But pre-64 coinage has a sales tax on it. So if you go buy your coins from a coin shop, you pay sales tax. And my point there is, if you're buying, let's say, $100 worth or more, it pretty much offsets the shipping. So if you're buying in increments of $100, you can do it at a shop, you can do it on eBay, and as long as you're buying online from somebody outside of your state and you don't pay state sales tax, it's a break-even proposition, so either way works. As far as creative ways you can do it outside of those two ways, I don't have a tremendous amount of suggestions for you. I do have one, and one that may be actually quite useful. You may want to take out, and this is only though if you're going to be buying enough volume to make it worth doing, an advertisement in your local paper or place it on Craigslist or any other internet classifieds or buying pre-64 silver coins. Send an email or whatever with what you have for a quote. And then all you can do is say, look at what people are selling for that are selling at the bottom end of the market on eBay or at coin shops, and go 10% under that, and you're saving 10%. It's a private sale. You probably meet the guy somewhere, at a coffee shop or whatever, give him some cash. He gives you the coins, and you're good. And so there's no, you don't have to worry about tax in that situation, right? Okay, it's between you and the other guy, private transaction, used goods, what have you. So I think that would be about the only other way I can suggest you do it. Finding them in circulating coins occasionally happens. I found a dime like 3 weeks ago, and I said, well, look at that, a silver dime, and I chucked it in. But today, if you find a dime or a quarter or any silver in circulation, odds are some kid raided his parents' coin box and spent it, and it doesn't stay in circulation long. The store clerk didn't realize what it was, just threw it in the cash register. You might be the second person to touch it since it went into circulation. It just doesn't stay out in circulation very long anymore. I guess you could get a metal detector and start checking around old farmhouses. That's kind of a hobby. I don't think you're ever going to make a profit on a reasonable basis with that. If you want silver coins, the only way I know to get them anymore is to buy them. You can look at garage sales and things like that, but it's not like people don't know. It's not like people don't get it. People understand silver is money. The days where people just like, oh, I have this collection, what's it worth? And you could tell them, oh, it's worth $50, and you don't really know what it's worth, but you know it's worth more than $50, and they would say yes. Those days are long gone, and we should be taking advantage of people anyway. Right, there is something to be said for buyer beware, but there's also something to be said for being a reasonable person. And, with that, you really have to think about what you're doing there. So my way is by buying them. I think putting out an ad looking to buy and paying about 10% over what the market is selling at is probably a really good way, because you're not going to get much more than that with most junk silver today at a coin shop anyway, so you cut out the middleman in that situation, so to speak. So with that, let's go ahead and take another question. This is an interesting question, and it's one of those ones that I think people go and have debates over without enough knowledge to really effectively have a debate. I think the guy that's asking the question gets that. He's looking for some validation of what he feels in his gut. I think his gut's right. Guy's name is Chris. Let's say Christopher. Distinguish him from the other Chris. Chris says, on the heels of your latest podcast, I have a philosophical question for you. Examining a recent shooters forum debate on using 223 for deer hunting and filtering out the inexperienced responses, there seems to be two schools of thoughts on the issue. One is use the right tool for the job philosophy, which says grab a good center fire rifle like a 30-06 and learn to use it. And the other is this is my weapon philosophy, where the idea is being well practiced in shot placement. In general, do you think it's better to spend a lot of time with a single weapon that you love or have multiple loves for various situations? This is an important issue for me because I have a day job that doesn't allow me to spend all day at the range. I would love to hear your thoughts on this issue and the 223 AR-15 platform in general for all-around survival. Thanks, tried to make it short. Okay, Chris, that's short, and that's good, and that's the length of email you guys need to send me if you want it on the air, right? If you send me five paragraphs, I probably am not going to have the ability to take the time to read it. You guys can't send me books for shows like this. So here's my first thought on that. The 223 is not a deer round. It's not, period. Will it work? Sure it will work. Under the right circumstances with good shot placement, etc. If I were in a situation where I needed to kill a deer and had a 223, do I think it's better than a sharp stick? You bet. I'm probably most likely to do a headshot with it, just to be sure, unless I'm loaded up with a very specific type of ammunition. There is a 55-grain Nosler partition bullet for the 223. There's a couple other really good, strong bullets for the 223 that are very effective with long shots, especially if you stick to ranges of about 100 yards or less, where you can guarantee a good long shot with it. A lot of the guys that take kids hunting in Texas at ages I think are a bit young, but hey, if the kid's up to it, I say go ahead and give it a shot. Are using those type of ammunition to allow the kid to be shooting something like a 223 with low recoil. I think even in those situations, if you have your choice, you're better off stepping up to something like a 243. A 243 is a very low recoil rifle, especially if you get something with a little bit of weight to it. Most of these guys that are doing that have these kids in these box blinds. You've heard my thoughts on that. Don't hate them, but, you know, at that age, I get why you would do that. They're only firing the rifle one time at a deer. I think you would be better off with a 243. This concept of know your weapon, and that's your weapon, and you always use your weapon for everything, the same guy that says that, go to his house and see how many guns he has. And I guarantee you that 90% of them have a closet or a locker full of guns. And they say, well, why don't you get rid of all these? And they'll give you all this justification for why they have that, because in their heart they know that weapons are purpose-built tools. The 223 in an AR-15 platform is not for hunting, especially not for hunting deer, okay? It's not what it's made for. It's made for killing men, and it's made for more than just killing men. It's made to wound and maim men. The 223 was not brought in as a round for our troops and for NATO troops because it was a highly lethal round. It was because it was light, cheap, easy to shoot, and highly effective at causing wounds that take the opposing soldier out of the fight, right? Be it through death or extreme damage. And that's what the 223 is. That's what it was built for. It makes a great varmint round. It makes a great self-defense round. It has a huge traumatic effect. You are not a deer, and a deer is not you. And I have seen deer wounded in ways where a man would not even have flinched, fell straight to the ground, go 100 yards or more. It is not a good deer round. It is an acceptable deer round with very specific situations. Now, this know your weapon crap, I agree with that to a degree. Have a weapon you train with all the time. But if you can take your AR-15 and hit the kill zone on a deer, then you can take a scoped 270 or 30-06 or 243 or 260 or 7mm or 08 or any caliber that's a better caliber weapon and shoot a deer with it. So the survival situation, I think most of these people with this, well, the survival situation, I'm going to have my one main battle rifle and it'll be my hunting rifle, and they run, and they're armchair survivalists. And they're these people that watch Rendon 57 times in a year, still. And they're not in touch with reality. So you're going to use your 223 for survival hunting. Okay, great. Good, Jeff, fine, you're going to do that. Okay, great. Big game, gone almost overnight in that real huge shit-hit-the-fan scenario. There won't be a lot of big game around. What will be out there hunting and trapping is small game. Big game, long-term, better, but there's not going to be as much of it available. So squirrels, rabbits, things like that. You going to shoot that with a 223? Unless you definitely get a headshot, you ain't got much left to eat. You shoot a squirrel with a 223. You guys that are convinced that you can do this, that's my challenge for you. Go find a little gray squirrel somewhere where it's legal. Shoot them with your 223. See what happens to them. See what's left for you to consume. Nothing. So what does that mean? Well, that means that at minimum, we need a shotgun or a 22 for our small game hunting. So we're already out of the one-gun philosophy as it is. So 223 and an AR-15 platform lost on woods or out in the woods for some reason, need to feed myself, there's a deer. Does it work? Yes. If you're going to rely on shooting deer as a hunter, or even in a long term, I'm going to augment my food situation with deer meat, 223 is a primary tool. Absolutely, positively not. And there's very few times where I say, if you don't agree with me, you're wrong. But in this case, I'm pretty comfortable saying that, because it's not what the tool was designed for. It should be the exception, not the plan. If you're looking at it ahead of time, you're making a plan. That means you have a choice, and you have the opportunity to change the choice and make a different one, right? So you're not being dropped into the wilderness 50 miles from home with no idea of where you're actually at, handed a couple tools and said, find your way back. Different scenario. You're planning now. Have a center fire, a good quality medium bore center fire, and learn to shoot it. You know? You want an AR platform for hunting medium game? That's a 308, my friends. 7.62. Good deer round. But the weapon that you guys are carrying around, these black white rifle fanatics, I have nothing against you. Got one of my own. Love it. But the ammunition you guys are carrying around, it's terrible deer ammunition. It's absolutely terrible deer ammunition. So if you're going to have different ammo, just have a different gun. If you can't get your hands on that gun, you fall back to using that single weapon. But don't make it your plan. It's the wrong plan. Here, I'm going to humor a guy here, and I'm going to read a book email because he broke it into four different parts, and each one is not a book, and each one could be answered. So since he did that, I'm going to go ahead and do this because I think it'll be a good wrap-up to the show by the time I get through this whole thing. I know you probably get into the questions, but here's a couple I have I would appreciate. Gardening. I live in Vegas. We have poor quality soil, extreme temperatures. Do you have any advice on where to learn about gardening in the Southwest? I'd like to incorporate permaculture. Is that possible in this climate? Are there any books you can recommend to get me started? I've attached 4 photos of my yard. As you can see, I have a clean slate to work with. The back is about 2,325 square feet. My wife and I have all our debts paid except our house and cars. Working on rebuilding an emergency fund. We'd like to save for a couple months before we take on any more big projects. We start composting, help soil where we're saving. Yes, compost fixes soil. Mulch fixes soil. I don't care if you have gravel, sand, enough compost and mulch will fix your soil. Another thing you might try is adding some things to retain moisture to your soil. So I'm a big on not digging and tilling soil, but what you may want to do with where you're going to prepare your beds is dig this soil once, because there's nothing down there right now. I see the pictures, guys. Typical Vegas, typical gravel, gravel and sand and desert floor look to it. So you may want to dig out some of that, remove some of it even, and create a depression, and then mix in with that some bentonite clay, a little bit of bentonite, and a lot of organic matter, and actually get some clay into the sand to help retain moisture. And you definitely want to use depressions, and you probably want to build kind of a rain garden setup. If you check out the pictures at Midwest Permaculture, what Bill Wilson did, it's not going to look the same because it's a totally different environment than Illinois, but something along those lines, and running the water off of the roof of your home when you do get rain out there into that garden is probably a good idea. My other suggestion is that you consider planting some things that do grow well in the desert is overstory to create shade. So these might be palms. They could even be edible palms like date palms. And anything that will grow well in that environment. You'll probably find that figs will do very well there. You may have to water them, but basically what you can do is you plant your fig tree or your palm tree or whatever in a sort of a depression, kind of exactly the opposite of what landscapers do, with almost like a moat on the outside of it, and fill the moat with organic matter, with things that will help the soil grow. Create some overstory. That'll give some shade. Now, you don't want to shade out the backyard completely, but if you give it some shade, it'll help with shade on the house. And then wherever you're planting your gardens, you want to kind of plan that shade to shelter the garden for parts of the day so things don't scorch under the sun, and then grow the things that handle hot climates better for your vegetables. These would be things such as okra is going to handle the heat. New Zealand spinach will handle the heat fairly well. There's a lot of things you can do. I would stick to fruits and vegetables. I would stick to fruits, and trees and bushes and things that are kind of ideal for desert climates. Pomegranates will probably do really good out there. So you may not have the typical garden with a lot of annuals in it and a lot of the typical herbs in it, but you'll be surprised at what will grow, especially if you provide some mottled shade with some overstory plants. You can turn anything into a green oasis with enough time. The things you need are organic matter and water. If you have organic matter and water and you're willing to experiment with as many species, throw stuff in there. This grew. I'll keep working with this. This died. I don't use this anymore. You can create an oasis anywhere. For inspiration, check out Greening the Desert with Jeff Lawton. Look at, can you put mini swales in your yard? Or, create a rain garden. How can you maximize any water that does fall and rehydrate the soil and build up some sort of ongoing organic matter where things are growing to provide organic matter for your property? It's a tough environment. I'm not going to say that it isn't, but if you want to make the effort, you can. The other thing to look at is building a green/shade house. Your winters are actually pretty cold. You do get freezing nights because of the cool desert air. A greenhouse will allow you to grow annual vegetables. Using some shade netting in combination with the greenhouse will let you grow through the hottest part of the year. It might be a great place if you have enough space in that backyard, it looks like you do, to put in a little green/shade house with an aquaponics setup. By using aquaponics and constantly recirculating the water, the plants are always watered, they're less subject to dry out, they're inside a greenhouse, obviously well-ventilated greenhouse in the summertime, completely open, which is some overhead cover, closed in and make it easy to do during the wintertime. Aquaponics, tilapia, love the heat. They'll do great out there. Best fish for aquaponics anyway. And because you're constantly saturating the roots with new water, you don't get the drought effects. Very water effective use. So there's a lot of options. It's just up to you to decide how much work you want to put into it initially and ongoing. Aquaponics is going to be work. It's not that hard, but you're going to have to work a little bit with it every single day, just a little bit. But it's not going to be that big a deal to set up a little aquaponics, set up a little greenhouse, shade house, and get that going. That's going to be a little bit of work up front, and maybe even some intense work for a while, and then it's going to be up and running, and it's going to be a system. But it's going to have to be a system you touch all the time. If you want to go with a permaculture system, you want a backyard of pomegranates and figs and anything else you can get to grow there, and shade and a canopy system working, it's going to be a massive amount of work for probably 2 to 5 years. But once you're done with it, it'll take care of itself. You might have to work for an hour a week other than going out and picking things. It's really up to you. But that option is open to everybody. You just have to adjust it. Next one is college savings fund. I'd like to start saving money for my future children, but I'd rather do it outside of the system. Do you have any ideas? Actually, it's probably a good place to keep some money in the system, setting up some mutual funds along with some cash, along with some staggered CDs is probably a good place, because you're looking for something that can be converted to cash. And that's one thing the system does, is give you things that are convertible. You say future children, so you don't have them yet. So let's say you have a kid next year, you're looking at a minimum of 19 years from now. And there's going to be up and downside in the marketplace all through that period of time. So I would look at that. Here's what I would stay away from. It's something I did not stay away from. It's a mistake I made. I would stay away from the state programs where you buy this one I didn't do. You buy the school tuition today at today's price, and your kids can go to school. They call them tomorrow funds and things like that. A lot of people are getting bills for differentials because it went up more than we expected, so the states are breaking their promises on a lot of these, and that is too much inside the system. The other thing I would stay completely away from, and this is the mistake I made, is a 529A plan. We saved a big chunk of money for our son in a 529A, and that meant that he has to use that money for college. And it's very expensive and highly penalized to take that money out for anything other than school. Fortunately, our son's going to college. He's not overly enthusiastic, but he's doing it. But what if your kid decides, I don't want to go to college? What if you have a $50,000 fund set up for your kid? He says, I don't want to go to college. Well, then you know what I would do? To have a very long, serious conversation with that young man about why he doesn't want to go, or young lady, and say, well, what do you want to do? Let's figure out what you want to do. And let's figure out how to get you training, or get you started, or get you apprenticed. And let's say that you have a kid, and he says, you know what I want to do? I've been listening to survival podcasts. I want to be a permaculturist. I want to go out there, and I want to help set up sustainable agricultural systems. Well, $50,000 can get you a long way into that. Now, I'd still say that person might do well from some marketing classes and things like that, but maybe it's not a degree. Maybe it's kind of, you know, going in and, you know, taking the audit style where I need about 10 courses and I'm going to pay for these individually. Maybe it's going and taking training. Maybe it's traveling around the world and getting credentials and getting training in other schools. Maybe it's, you know what, I'm going to take 25 of the 50 and buy my first house with it, and then I'm going to, you know, get a job, but I'm going to pursue this. There's so many things that are flexible. And I think we should keep flexibility in our children's future. And it's a mistake I made, but you don't know any better when you, and I was still in the system when we set that up. And I didn't understand that I was locking him into a single choice, spend this money on school. And I wish today that he had a better choice, but because we've taught him the same things, he really does, because he has his own money he saved, and he's doing quite well with that philosophy himself, no debt, paid for car, that type of thing, at 20 years old. I would bet he has a bigger savings account than the average American that's 40 years old, because we've taught him that philosophy. But it would be much more if we had put that money aside for him in just CDs. It's probably the best thing that we could do, or treasury notes. You know, you can't do cash. Not with that amount of money. Inflation hits it too hard. You've got to pull a few points of interest out of it. CDs are relatively safe. They do have, some of them have a penalty for early withdrawal, but if you stagger them, there's only so much that's more than a year out. And you can always pay the penalty if something looks like really bad is coming and liquidate and go to cash and convert it to another asset. So that's how I would handle planning for my children's future. I would get the word college fund out of your vocabulary. You don't set up a college, I don't believe this anymore. I used to. You don't set up a college fund for a child that's not born yet. You don't set up a college fund for a child that's 1 year old. You do not set up a college fund for a child that's 12 years old. When that kid's 18, 20 years old and out of high school, there's no guarantee that they're going to be want to go to college or they're suitable for college. And you people, my kid's going to college. Your kid, when he goes to college, isn't a kid. He's a young man or a young woman. Free to make their own choices. Liberty for all, especially your children. So keep flexibility in their lives for them so that they can make the choices that are really right. That doesn't mean you don't take control of the money and go, an 18-year-old shouldn't be handed a $50,000 bank account and told to go nuts unless you've got a kid that's exceptional. They might need guidance with it. You might say, you know what? You want to do things your way? I think you're going down the wrong road, kiddo. I'm going to hold on this. Come back when you're 21. We'll discuss it again. You might at 21 say, you know, this is my money. I have the money here for you. But you might have to come back at 25. Or we're going to sit down and start planning your life together because I put this aside so that I can help you with your life. But if it's not something you totally love that they're going to do, but there's nothing wrong with it, and it might be what's right for them, then you support them with it. And you leave yourself that flexibility as well. Again, mistake I made, don't make it yourself. Three, in this little book email. Education. I've been reading about economics, the Constitution, and many other topics to better educate myself. I'd like to focus on economics and gardening. I read a few books from the Mises Institute and started with a list back, Ron Paul's and the Fed. Do you have any other suggestions? Economic theory will only take you so far. You can keep reading these books once in a while, but once you get the basics out of it, unless you're going to be in politics and setting policy, you get to a point of redundancy and it only creates anger. There's not a lot you can do if you understand basic Austrian economic theory and you understand fiat currency and you understand how wrong what we're doing is and you get how the Federal Reserve shell game works. And once you get all that, the only thing reading Moore tends to do is to make you angry and less productive. Now you're wasting your energy. I think there's a belief if I could just learn enough, I'll be a better evangelist. When I talk to somebody and they throw something back at me, I'll have a better way of answering it. Here's the deal. If you sit down, show somebody a $1 bill, show them where it says this note is legal tender, explain to them the basics of how the Federal Reserve works, explain that that dollar bill is not money, it is a certificate for debt, and explain to them that our country can never pay off our debt, no matter what any politician says, because if we had no debt, we would have no money in our current economic system. And if they don't believe that, they can read it for themselves on the Federal Reserve website, and that the Federal Reserve is not part of the government. It's a private group of banks, and you can show them where it says that, where you can show them the chairman of the Fed saying that to Congress and telling them basically, we'll do what we want, we'll advise you, but we get to make our own choices. If you can do all that, and they still have their fingers in their ear, and they're saying, la, 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 stop. You're not going to be a better evangelist than that. Your job when you're evangelizing anything is to open people to a possibility that things aren't what they seem, point them in the direction of a few resources, and saying, if you want to discuss this further, go check this stuff out and get back with me. Anything else is hard selling, and hard selling of ideas does not work. The harder you push, the harder people resist. I used to, when I would do talks about selling, I would have a person stand up out of the audience, and I'd say, put your hand up, you know, like you're about to lay your one hand on the Bible, like your right hand, you're going to say, you know, I do solemnly swear, put your right hand up in front of you like this. And they'd put their hand up. I'd put my hand up just like it, and I would start pushing on their hand. Before I'd say, stand up, so I want you to do everything I tell you to do. And they say, okay, right? They stand up, and I'd start pushing their hand. 99 out of 100, when I started pushing their hand, you know what they did? They pushed back. And I'd say, why did you push back? And they'd say, I thought you wanted me to. And I said, did I say to do everything that I told you to? Yes. Are you trying to create a conflict? And they'd say, no. And I'd say, no, calm down. This is just an exercise. You did exactly what I expected you to do. But why did you push back? I want you to examine your, why did you feel compelled to push back? And they'd say, because you were pushing. Well, with selling, it works the same way. With evangelizing, it works the same way. Once you're having to push an idea, once you're having to push, all you do is create greater resistance. So it's like, that's how these ideas get shared. And if it's a friend, you share them little bite-sized pieces, and you immediately switch the conversation to something that you know they want to talk about. You've just had your little niblet of the Federal Reserve System. You can tell the person's starting to resist. So, hey, anyway, who do you think's going to win the playoff game next week? Hey, you want another beer? Hey, let's bet on the next hole on this round of golf. That's how you do that. So, I don't know. Anything you find interesting with economics, go for it. On the other side, where you start talking about gardening, I have a tremendous number of things that I can suggest. But the biggest thing is, get involved in like local garden clubs and things like that. I'm becoming more and more convinced the best way to be a really good gardener and permaculturist is to observe. Which I should know because it's like principle one, in the principles of design is observe and interact. The more you look at, the more you see what's being done, the more you'll look at how you can adapt it to yourself. But some of the books that I would recommend, I just finally broke down. It's almost $100. I found a used copy on Amazon for $80. I broke down and I bought the Permaculture Design Manual by Bill Mullis. So not one or two, but the design manual. It's over 500 pages, tremendous amount of information. Big investment. Worth every penny. I've only had it for a day. It was one of the things sitting here for me when we got back from Arkansas. I was into it all last night for hours. It is amazing the things that you'll learn from this book. I think it's probably the best book I've ever read. A less expensive permaculture guide is the one that Bill Wilson uses with Midwest Permaculture's webinar series called An Earth User's Guide to Permaculture. That's under $20. Really recommend that. Square Foot Gardening by Mel Bartholomew is absolutely an excellent resource. Those are some of the big ones, but I would tell you that go to Google Video and YouTube. Search for gardening, permaculture, organic gardening, food forest, and dig into all the free content that's out there. Listen to my shows about these concepts. You can learn so much by what's out there for free. And when you feel like you've reached an impasse where I can't learn anymore, then start buying stuff. I think the webinar series from Bill Wilson, it's $195 at Midwest Permaculture, and I'm still dinging on them for a discount. For you guys. I'm trying to get a discount for you guys on that. Maybe $50 or something like that. But that said, $195 money well spent. I have like two more in the series to avail myself time to watch, but I've learned a tremendous amount from that. Gardening and agriculture is more about how you think than what you do. If you understand the concepts and you think, instead of seeing problems, you seek solutions. And this is what happens. I've got another email almost just like the one about Vegas, but it's a guy up in the northern climates, one of the coldest cities in the United States. How do I do this? It's too cold. Think about this. I got another guy saying it's too hot. Now, the guy that's up in the frigid cold is thinking, man, if I were in Vegas, I could grow anything I want. I mean, it ain't got no water, but it's warm there. All I got to do is figure out how to filter out some of that hot sun and get some water and some dirt. I can grow anything. That'd be great. Right, and the guy in Vegas is thinking, if it was cold, I'd just, hell, throw a greenhouse in. So we see the solution, right, that other people need. But we fail to see our own because we're locked inside of it. Now again, if you look for people that are successfully growing food where you live, you'll find solutions for yourself because they have the same problems you do. So observe, interact, get involved with local community. Go find a local farmer's market. I guarantee you there's a farmer's market in Vegas. And ask farmers, how do you grow this stuff? How do you pull this off? You know, you'll see a guy with a big pile of chilies and he goes, all you need is dirt and water. These things grow great out here. It's a perfect climate for it. You know, you'll see another person with something, you're like, how do you grow that? And there'll be something and most of these people will share that knowledge with you. You know? Ask them, hey, I need some seed stock, or I need some root stock, or I need some plants. Would you be interested in doing that so I can grow some of the stuff in my house? You know, I mean, reach out. That's the big thing. As far as books, there's a million great ones out there, but I'm really a fan of the Designer's Manual from Bill Mollison now. Something I should have bought a long time ago, but when you're paying that much for a book, it's hard to do. But I'd say every other page has a diagram or a picture or something like that on it. It's not just text. And those things convey so much more than just the text does. And it breaks it down into cool climates, warm climates, dry, arid, you name it, tropic, subtropic. There's chapters on all of that stuff, water harvesting. And it's so much more than just planting. Energy usage, home construction, dealing with waste. It's awesome. So I really recommend that. And let's go ahead and finish up what Brian had to say because it was pretty cool. Said, and this is humbling to hear this. Jack, people like you, Ron Paul, Peter Schiff and Judge Napolitano of Freedom Watch is where I first saw you. And many others truly bring tears to my eyes. Your dedication to family and country keep me listening. If more Americans followed more of the principles gentlemen like you preach, we'd have less debt slaves and more true Americans. And folks, that's what it's all about for me, creating true Americans. But as you know, I believe that the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence are the two most dangerous documents in the world because they do not apply to Americans, they apply to human beings. I don't just want to take my country back. I want to take my planet back. Crazy? No. The reason we have all these borders, the reason we have people whose stupid Mexicans are coming here and taking my jobs is because we have a global economic system that seeks to divide us. Are there people in this world that we have to fight at certain times? Yes. Are there systems of domination and oppression that we have to rise up against? Yes. Will we ever have a kumbaya Star Trek type world where all hunger, poverty, and crime is banished? I don't know. I doubt it. I know you and I won't see it, so it doesn't really matter. But we can make a dent in the problems that we have. A big-ass dent. We do that by being an example. Pride in America, absolutely. But more than being an American, you're a human being. If you're not a human being, being an American doesn't really mean much. Our entire system, the foundation of our nation, is not about, because you're an American, you have these rights. That would mean that your rights come from the government. Our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence, both state in a variety of ways that you as a human existing here were endowed by your Creator with certain inalienable rights. Notice it did not say endowed by Jehovah or Yahweh or Allah, endowed by your Creator, leaving room for all. Most of our founding fathers were not Christians. It's a myth. I know I'm going to get hate mail. It's a myth. They were deists. Look it up. Which meant they might have went to a church or whatever, but they recognized that all things, all people, and all creeds had various ways of looking at a higher power. And that what most mattered is that we accepted that there must be something else. And that something else is why we're here. Or part of why we're here. Or our choice to be here was based on coming from somewhere else. Didn't have to explain it, didn't have to understand it, but just understood that by standing here, we had certain things that we had a right to, such as our lives, our liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And those statements were made not just to our people, but to protect our people and be an example to other people. It was a global revolution when those words were penned and signed. Because for the first time ever, ever, in the history of the world, a nation rose up, a system of government rose up that was not just a democracy or not just a republic, but a government that inherently limited itself from day one, that said, the people have the power because they were given that power by their Creator. And that power should never be taken from them, should never be restricted. And the government's purpose is to defend and protect and uphold it. That's not just for Americans. It's for Mexicans, Canadians, Iraqis, Japanese, Chinese, Taiwanese, Germans, French, Italians, Brazilians, Argentinians, Panamanians, Puerto Ricans. And if I left your country out, I don't know all the countries of the world, and I can't just keep here listing them all off. But it's for everybody. That's for everybody. Not by our force, but by our statement and our example. And I believe with some of the things I've heard recently about what people are doing throughout the world, that taking responsibility for self, providing for self, and being part of your local community is the way to get that done. And that is best done not by threat, not like by political means, not by barter, not by anything other than example. So we start at home with our own examples, and we live that example, and we share that example with the rest of the world. And if we do that and disaster comes, we're better prepared to deal with it. If we do that and disaster does not come, we have thriving, improving lives, and we're not slaves to debt, and we're not slaves to government. That is the way to be, and that's the way to live that better life. This has been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't.
You can scream, and you can holler, it really doesn't matter, 'cause it all gets spent.